Welcome back to Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650 with Jamie Dodd and Thomas Drantz. We are live from the Kintech Studio. 650. 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Dunbar Lumber with three stores to serve you in Ladner on Bridge Street or Dunbar Lumber Express at Ladner Center or Arbutus in Vancouver online at dunbarlumber.com. Joining us now on the line to chat more about a incredibly entertaining, a spectacle game, whatever you want to call it, at Rogers Arena last night from the Canadian Press, our pal Gemma Karsten-Smith. Gemma, thank you. How are you feeling today after that one?
I feel tired. But in the best possible way. It's so much fun to cover playoff hockey, you guys. So much fun.
Yeah.
And I'm looking forward to seeing where the series goes.
Yeah, that was just such a cool series of moments. And, you know, the moment that stands out is when Dakota Joshua scores the goal. But the atmosphere from start to finish was phenomenal. And it was really, I mean, we've seen good atmospheres in this city, around the league. But, you know, I'm not sure I ever recall the reaction from the players post-game, right? They were so open about how struck they were by the atmosphere. What did you make of what the players had to say about that after the game?
JT Miller, who's like the embodiment of being like a tough hockey bro, got choked up talking about it. That's incredible. Like, that's to see how it impacted him is just incredible. Is truly probably the only word I can use to describe it. He said that after the birth of his children and his wedding, it was like the next closest thing, and that's just a reaction I didn't expect from him. Honestly, and Tyler Myers, to just seeing the look on his face talking about it, you could tell that it was already special for him. It was something that he's going to remember. And when Quinn Hughes talked about how it, like, even the atmosphere of Madison Square Garden didn't compare it, that's like kudos to Canucks fans, because those are hard memories to make, and they were the ones responsible for that last night.
Canucks fans brought it. Have you ever heard the building that loud? How much did it feel like a release of years of frustration from fans in the city to you?
Haven't even heard it close to that loud.
Yeah.
It's not even close to being a contest. That's how loud it was. And just the atmosphere and the buzz. And I kind of felt it building around the city over the past week or so. I've seen so many gosh darn car flags, guys. Like,
and they're all specifically honking at you now. People like, Gemma, look at my car flag.
You guys, I'm being trolled by these freaking car flags. It's ridiculous. Anyway, but the buzz has been building in the city, whether it's on the roads, on the seawall, wherever. I'm getting more and more people talking to me about hockey than I've ever had in my 6-7 years doing this job. This is the first playoff game that I've covered at Rogers Arena, and so I wasn't entirely sure what to expect. I've covered playoff hockey in other markets, in Edmonton and LA, and I've seen really incredible fan bases in both of those locations, but I wasn't really sure what to expect from Canucks fans, and like you said, they brought it. It was something else for sure, and like you said, it honestly felt like a release. This team has been through so much in the past few years, and to see that game in game one, it really felt like a storybook, not an ending, I guess,
sure,
but an opening chapter.
Storybook beginning. Yeah, I mean, if you look at it as last night as a singular event, I completely get what you're saying, right? The fact, and you know, the thing that stood out to me the most, Gemma, was even when the Canucks were losing, that they were like, as soon as they went down, right after that, there's go Canucks, go chance. There's that energy. It did not leave. It didn't dissipate at all. And, you know, I think maybe sometimes we can sometimes overrate the impact of the crowd on a game, but I don't think last night that was the case at all. I think they absolutely played a major role in spurring that Canucks team on.
Yeah. Rick Tocchet said before the game, I can't remember who it was who asked him. Someone asked him, what's your message to Canucks fans? It might have been Drantz.
Yeah, it was me.
But
It was me asking the hard-hitting questions.
I was
going to
say a rare, like, sentimental question from Drance.
There's your cookies, Drance.
So sorry, because we love to talk about the insides and outs of covering a team, Gemma. So I just want to do some backstory here. After Rick Tocchet said the embrace the pain thing in his previous availability, it struck me how much like a I'd expect to hear something like that from like Jurgen Klopp. Or like a European football coach.
So
it sort of got me thinking, and I was like, you know what? Before big games, fans or media always ask European soccer coaches, like, what do you hope to see from the supporters section? There's this like intertwining of the supporters with the sort of team itself from the manager on down. And I was like, I wonder if Tocchet will pick up what I'm putting down if I throw this at him. And that's why I sort of asked that question. He did. It was a great answer.
He said, they need to be loud, get loud. And they were. And that's great. To see that kind of give and take, awesome. So cool. It, like you said, Drance, it really was kind of that European soccer, or European football, my apologies.
Wow.
Give and take there. Look what you've done.
I know, I'm sorry. I regret it.
In terms of the on-ice element of the last night, who stood out the most in a positive sense for you for the Canucks?
Lindholm. I thought that he was really noticeable all night. I love the play that he made on that Joshua goal. I thought that it was just, like, chef's kiss. But I also like what he said post-game about, like, this is what I'm here for. He knows. And he knows that we've been talking about it, right? And not just us, but literally everyone in hockey media. Everyone knows it was a high price of acquisition. He was the biggest name left on the board at that point. Like, that was a blockbuster deal. And he hasn't lived up to it thus far. Last night, he showed that he could and what he is capable of. And not just with his goal. Yeah, his goal tied the game at 1-1 and it really sparked that kind of comeback. But he showed that he's got other things to give as well. I thought he fit in really well on that line. I thought that he played excellent with Joshua and Garland. And I'm excited to see what he can do. Because we've talked so much about how the Canucks have depth down the middle and how that is so challenging to defend against. This is such a good case in point of that and what that could do to another team, really wear them down and kind of grind down an opposition. It's hard to defend four lines, right? Like, that's just math. There's only so many players on the ice and so much bandwidth that they have to give. So when you've got everyone cooking like that, it's good to see.
What did you think about the overall flow of the game, and in particular the performance of the Predators and sort of the challenge they offered? Given what you saw in Game 1, have you shifted your view of what to expect this series?
So I'll preface this by saying that I came in thinking this would be a six-game series. So I'll start there. I think my prediction was Canucks in six. So when that isn't the case, you can all come at me. But I thought that the Predators came out stronger in the first period yesterday. I thought that the first 10 minutes of the game were chaos. I like what JT Miller said about, might as well not have been a puck, because that is kind of how it felt. It was just like, just rabble. But I thought that the Preds held the momentum early. I thought that the Canucks looked a little bit tentative, but coming into the second period, especially off the Lindholm goal, they really found their footing offensively and then got into some penalty trouble, obviously, but still pushed with that offense. And that's what we saw come alive in the third there. So I think that the first half of the game was Nashville for the taking, and where you saw the Canucks come in strong was after killing those three penalties. They really took control and found their game and found their kind of confidence, which isn't surprising, right? Like, so many of the guys on the team don't have playoff experience, real playoff experience anyway, and they're facing a lineup that you got Ryan O'Reilly, enough said. So I wasn't surprised by any of that. It was a really physical game. What was it, 71 hits, something like that? So I think that embracing the pain is definitely something both teams will have to do going forward here. But I think Vancouver is built for this. And I'm so excited to see what the what the rest of the series has to hold.
Do you think Nashville should feel more disappointed that they lost a game that they were leading in the third period? Or should they feel more, I don't want to say excited, but should they be a little satisfied or feel good about themselves based on the fact that they were able to, dictate the tempo early in the game and keep it so close?
I think if Nashville loses this series, they will see game one as a disappointment, for sure, because it was theirs for the taking. For sure. But I don't think either side can say that was a bad game. I think both teams had great opportunities and showcased their best, but also have a long way to grow. So, like I said, I just think that there's a lot more to be seen here. But neither side went away from that game going, oh, that really, that was a bit of a stinker there. I really think that there's a lot more to be seen from both sides. What I thought was really interesting coming into this game was how both sides are kind of, in a way, positioning themselves as the underdog.
Uh-huh.
Like, you can't both be underdogs. That's not how it works. But Nashville came in saying, no one expected us to be here. And then Rick Tocchet yesterday said, no one expected us to be here either. And they're both right. I mean, at different points of the season. I think heading into the season, Nashville was expected to be a playoff team and expected to be here, but the Canucks weren't. And then midway through the season, the Canucks were expected to be here and then Nashville wasn't. So,
so it goes.
Guys, it's so exciting.
Gemma, so again, it was me sort of bringing the brunette commentary to Tocchet, right?
Yeah.
And he's sort of rejected the idea that they're favorites, and I was like, well, you are, right?
Yeah.
And then I thought it was interesting because he did kind of put the mask down a little bit and was just like, we expect to win. And I think that was, there's something matter of fact and unafraid about Tockett's commentary and what he's willing to share with us that I find very interesting, refreshing, however you want to put it. What's your sense of it? Where do you think it stems from? How do you think it interacts with who this head coach is?
He's a no BS guy.
Right.
I think that we've seen that from him basically since he came in here, right? Like, he's been like that in so many different regards. We talk so much about how he's willing to talk X's and O's and talk about F1s getting in versus F2 and blah, blah, blah. Get really into the nitty-gritty of hockey. But he's also not afraid to talk about his philosophy and his stance on the game and all of these different things. And it's refreshing is the right word for it, because it's not something that we get all the time. But he's completely unafraid. He is confident in himself. He is confident in his players. He is confident in his team. And his team, not just the players on the ice, but the people he's surrounded himself with, these assistant coaches and the trainers. From A to Z, he is confident in this group. And he believes in what they're doing. No matter what happens, Rick Tocchet believes in his group. And I think that's what we're seeing, right? We're seeing that confidence, and that confidence has transformed into preparation and now into, what's another word for output? We're now seeing it come to life, really. Mm. So he's been writing this book for a long time. And he might try to, just offer us what's it called? The galley, where the preview of it.
Oh,
but every now and again, he's willing to open the cover and show us some of the gems hidden inside.
Gemma, we got this text in. I went and got a car flag on Saturday just for Gemma. So you've re-inspired Canucks Nation to get on the car flag bandwagon, Gemma. So congratulations to you for that.
As the Predators fans will sing to Thatcher Demko if he allows a goal at any point, it's all your fault. does anyone remember, do Canucks fans watch enough Predators games to know to expect this?
I don't know.
No.
I don't think so.
The answer is no.
So they have a song that they sing after goals in which they chant the goalie's
name. Speaking of European football.
Yeah, and then
classic.
Chant.
Classic. Yeah. I love it. It's all your fault.
And
chant.
Then
so
chant,
good.
It's all your fault. Yeah.
Gemma, thank you as always. Look forward to chatting next week.
Bye, guys. Have a great week.
That is Gemma Carson-Smith from the Canadian press weighing in on last night.
The other thing Predators fans do during the starting lineup. Do you know about this?
No, I was going to say, do they have, are they one of the people who like yells something during the anthem?
I don't remember. I don't think so. They have during starting lineups, right? So it'll be like, you know, the Vancouver Canucks will start number 35, Thatcher Demko. And then they go, he sucks. And then they go, he sucks, he sucks, he sucks through the whole lineup. And then they introduce the last player and he sucks too.
Sure.
Yeah, that's how they do it.
Big soccer vibes. Like, that reminds me of Whitecaps games.
Honestly,
right?
One of the things, like, this series is going to be so cool. First of all, the matchup's awesome. The hockey itself was, like, incredibly appealing. And some of what both Brunette and Tocchet were trying was fascinating to watch. But then the crowds are so unique. Like, these are two of the most eccentric, different, high vibes, high energy crowds. Like, the atmosphere at every game in this series is going to be through the roof. I'm so thrilled.
And Jay in Mount Pleasant texts in, I keep thinking about Gemma every time I see a car flag now, first of all. And then he says, also, why do you all think we were louder yesterday than, say, 2011? That's from Jay in Mount Pleasant. And the easy answer is the gap, right? Like, the 9-year gap between hosting a playoff game and just the pent up, as you said, a release of so many different emotions, a catharsis, right? To get fancy on you. Rick Dollywell can go look that one up later. But that's the easy answer. And I think even more
Rick can't even find his catharsis.
Even more than that, it wasn't as if they missed the playoffs for a long time and then they had a kind of typical straightforward path back to the playoffs, right? Mm. Like, it wasn't like they had this long drought, but then they drafted Elias Pettersson and Quinn Hughes and they got steadily better for 3 years and then they made the playoffs as an 8th seed, right? That would be one thing, and it would still look, the atmosphere still would have been phenomenal. But I think because there was a gap, because there was the kind of bubble experience, which I do think added to it. It was like, oh, we almost got to see it, but it was such a fake, unsatisfying version of it. Like, yeah, it was exciting in the moment, but it didn't feel tangible afterwards. And then because of all of the ups and downs, the lows, some highs, but especially the lows, I think all of that adds up to it was always going to be a special atmosphere in that building, more so even than when the team was like more traditionally competitive, I think. I think everything that transpired over the last 10 years went into making that crowd as loud, as emotional, as fantastic as they were last night.
I think that's fair. I think that's right. You know, and look, this is just the start of something. Game one, you win it. Mm-hmm. That's awesome. What does it mean when the puck drops on Tuesday? Well, it means you have a chance to go up 2-0. But that's about it, right? I mean, this is the start of something, but for something to start and then start in a special way, I do think that helps. Like, I do think that's not long term, but I do think it helps get that buy-in, get that excitement going. Like, the idea, the Canucks were sending emails to season ticket holders reminding them that tickets were still available about an hour before that game. I promise you that's not happening.
Yeah, on Tuesday. Well, it's a great point. And, you know, you asked Tocchet the question, and as you explained to Gemma there, kind of the allusion to European football and where the club and the supporters, there's a much closer tie, right? And to the point where they almost become as one. And I think, obviously, it's great for the Canucks as a team to get that victory and come from behind and kind of establish their footing in the series in game one, you know, especially for a team with a lot of players who've never been in this environment. But I think for the fans to walk out of that building and for even in a game where the Canucks won and where there was a lot of really fascinating on-ice things happening, for the kind of the dominant story to be that crowd was amazing, that crowd impacted the game, to hear the love returned by the players and for them to talk about how meaningful, as you said, that's only going to drive demand to be at these games up, right? Like, that to me establishes kind of the template, the blueprint for what this crowd can be, for what they can do. And, you know, I don't want to get too sentimental here, but it does feel like a bit of like a symbiotic thing developing between the team and the crowd, right? Where the crowd's going to have their back, they're going to push them. And if the players return, I think it's just going to spiral. It's going to snowball and it's just going to keep getting better. As you said, like, game two, who wouldn't want to be a part of that now?
Well, it's also game one, right? So game one, game two, that's one thing. Game seven, right? are we at the point where you would confidently say that this team has shed the this crowd can get nervous when things go against them baggage?
No.
Built up over 50 plus years in the city, right? Like, we'll see how this evolves. But, you know, Tockett was noting that even when they were down, this you know, 3-0 or whatever, it seemed like there was still support and belief in how this crowd has supported this team throughout this season. Does that prove durable as the inevitable slings and arrows of outrageous hockey fortune come to bear at some point on the Canucks, whether it's this round, the next one, or if we're getting greedy, the one beyond that and beyond that?
It's a totally fair question, and you can only kind of prove it game by game, whether you're the team, whether you're the crowd or whatever. Yep. But again, it passed a test last night, right? Ugh. Because they went down and there was no let up whatsoever.
And the other thing is, I don't know that we should just accept that this was louder. Like, I would say, like, 2011 game 5 of the Stanley Cup final was a wild atmosphere. I mean, this building has, I think this building hit some peaks that were very comparable in 2011. I just think last night was such a release for this city. It was so long, such a long time coming. And man, could you feel that, like, even before the game, from warm-ups on?
Yeah, no doubt about it. It was a very, very special night. All right, we got a ton of texts coming in. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. You can get your thoughts in. We'll dive back into the on-ice aspect of things, including some of the, you know, the tactical matchups, the tactical kind of cat and mouse game between Rick Tockett and Andrew Brunette, what adjustments we might see, what to expect going forward in game 2, and we'll read your texts as well. As a reminder, the Canucks, as Duran said, probably going to do a short practice at Rogers Arena at 12:30, so we'll see if there's any news in terms of lineup notes, anything that comes out of that. Hopefully we'll get some Rick Tockett audio that we can turn around and play at some point during the show as well. Allison Lucan will join us at 12:30. More Canucks talk coming up on the way here on Sportsnet 650.
Hey, it's Vic Nizar. Have your say and join me on The People's Show with big takes and even bigger bets weekdays 3 to 4 on Sportsnet 650 or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650 with Jamie Dodd and Thomas Drance. Canucks Talk brought to you by Avenue Machinery and Douglas Lake Equipment. Be a champion on the worksite. Find them together online at DLEAMC.com. We are live from the Kintec studio. Kintec, Canada's favorite orthotics provider, powered by thousands of five-star Google reviews. Sore feet, what are you waiting for? 650. 650! Is the Dunbar Lumber text line. All right, lots of texts coming in, and fair enough, lots of them coming in about Elias Pettersson specifically. This one, hey, you thought Forsberg was bad, but what about No Show Petey? Is he a chance-generating $11.6 million superstar or a third liner? And definitely, I think, the fly in the ointment from a lot of Canucks fans' perspective. And even, you know, I did my typical thing where I log on and I lurk in the inbox a little bit during the postgame show. And the only negative texts coming in at that point were about Elias Pettersson's performance. Now, I do think, like, a lot of the, like, was he even playing? I didn't even notice him. He was invisible. I think that stuff's a little overblown. Like, if you didn't notice Elias Pettersson in that game, you weren't paying very close attention.
Well, he played top line minutes.
Yeah.
So, I mean,
so like, I that stuff I think is a little over the top. But having said that, I'm not going to sit here and say that he played a phenomenal game either.
So really quickly, 5-on-5, Besser led all Canucks forwards. Miller second, Pettersson third. Okay. And then you get the Lindholm, Garland, Joshua axis, which is how we can say all of the following are true. Okay. The Lindholm line was Vancouver's second line. All of them played second line minutes.
Mm-hmm.
But Pettersson, Miller, Besser played top line minutes, partly because they played 237 together as a trio, a lotto line trio. Mm-hmm. And by the way, those were bad minutes.
Yep.
Those were really... Now, Pettersson had one really sick chance that he like just missed, but his creativity cutting inside to set it up was nice. Was really nice. There were moments...
He also had that jam play at the side of the net early in the yep. first, which was maybe their best scoring chance in the first period.
Well, and he's streaking down the right wing, right, on his one-timer side, like in a very, very dangerous spot if he gets the puck, and Lafferty hit Myers as the trailer instead, and the Canucks didn't get a shot attempt on that rush chance late in the first, right? I thought Pettersson was getting to his places offensively, but just did what? Honestly, I didn't think he was getting the puck. I didn't think he was getting service, frankly, from his line mates or his teammates. And when he did get a couple of, in my view, really, really high quality looks or chances, they were near misses. So, yeah, because he also had the one wrist shot on the power play where he mm-hmm. tested Saros' mm-hmm. blocker, which, again, I thought was a smart play and a dangerous shot and a tough save for Saros. Like, Saros fought that off. That was not an easy save. So... I thought Pettersson offensively got his looks. Now, there was also a play that I thought was very bad from Pettersson. And it was late in the game, 90 seconds left. And it was Nashville's real final chance before Dakota Joshua scored the empty netter. And it ended up being a shot from the Predators' right flank. And there's sort of a battle along the wall that Pettersson loses outright. And then he's leaning with his stick into the shot lane and not like really moving his feet or defending it very well. And I watched that and I thought, ooh, that is not good enough, especially in this moment, holding on to a lead this narrow with how this game has gone. I didn't like that. But that was the only sequence in the game where I thought he played poorly. I didn't think that line worked.
No. And I will say on Pettersson, and again, this is not supposed to be like, oh, defending Pettersson or anything like that, because obviously he can be way better.
Can we credit Bieksa too? Because I thought that breakdown of what happened on the Predators' first goal, was useful because Pettersson was late to close out on Zucker, but it was because a teammate made an error, not because of him. And that's the sort of thing that even I, or like a media member, like someone who's like really watching closely, isn't going to see the way someone like Kevin Bieksa, who like really knows how goals are scored and prevented because it was his life and his job.
Yeah.
Right. He sees it differently, sees it better and more accurately. I thought that was a really helpful breakdown because I'm sure a lot of fans yelling at their TVs last night were like, oh, Pettersson, get to the shot. Where's your cap?
I thought that there have been games down the stretch where I was not concerned like long term about Elias Pettersson, but games where it was like, I felt like he was fighting it. You know what I mean? Games where it's like, ah, he bobbled the puck there, or, you know, he looked off a good shooting chance there. Just doesn't seem quite right. I didn't necessarily think that last night. Like, I thought he was engaged. It was more, it wasn't, again, I would say it's different than, I didn't think he was off. I just didn't think he had a big impact. But there was nothing I saw last night that made me, like, concerned about him for the rest of the series. You know what I mean? So, I would almost differentiate it between some of the performances we saw down the stretch and last night. Like, I thought it was fine compared to, again, some of the things we saw late in the season from Elias Pettersson.
So, concern for the rest of the series. Can we put that into a sort of more low-key context? Like, not a concern, but something to watch in terms of something that could emerge as an edge for the Predators. I do think is, like, Vancouver's edge 5-on-5 was almost entirely isolated to the
Miller Hughes minutes.
Miller versus McCarron head to head minutes, right? A 5-minute completely baffling matchup sort of decision that I don't like. Tockett noted post game that he didn't really chase it. And I think that's right. You know, like he jumped the Predators fourth line with his starting lineup. And then the Predators, Kiefer Sherwood put the puck over the glass in the neutral zone and the Predators stuck with the matchup. Like it wasn't a matchup that the Predators were keen to work to avoid to any extent. So I think they're comfortable to some extent with McCarron versus Miller head to head. And they think that if they punt that matchup, it will benefit them elsewhere in the lineup. We'll see. That sounds like a tough That's definitely a tough bet to try and make here, but I mean, it's not an unreasonable one given how Vancouver sort of fared in all other minutes. I think when I consider it, though, again, not a concern, but something to watch for is outside of the top of the lineup, right? With those sort of those middle 6 minutes, I thought the Predators did really well, especially once they united Zucker, Evangelista, and Sissons as a second line. And if that's going to be like, that's a durable edge that I do think Vancouver and Pettersson in particular need to find a way to neuter,
mm-hmm.
right? If this series is going to be one where Vancouver needs to make their possession count with Miller on the ice on the scoreboard, I do think that's a fine line to walk in a seven game series, especially if Nashville is going to be able to get chances with their bottom or their second line and their third line on the ice.
Yeah, and if you look at it, if it does end up being, you know, if Nashville doesn't care too much about getting O'Reilly out there against Miller, and there are a lot of those McCarron versus Miller minutes, that probably means there's going to be a lot of Lindholm versus O'Reilly minutes, right? But then that does leave some theoretically, you know, softer minutes for Elias Pettersson, and he should be able to dominate those minutes, and he probably will need to have a game or two where he does dominate those minutes and really punish the Nashville Predators in this series. Obviously, he didn't do it last night. Hey, the Canucks won, so you're not too worried about it. And I still think he absolutely can. Now, I guess the other question is,
Can you do it with Sam Lafferty?
Yes, that's a totally fair question, I think, to have. Now, the pushback, of course, will always be like, hey, you're paying Elias Pettersson that much. He's got to find a way to elevate his line mates. He's got to find a way to get it done, you know, regardless of who's playing on his wing. And there's certainly some truth and some fairness to that argument, but you can only push it so far as well. And I think there's a reason that Elias Pettersson played almost 6 minutes more at even strength than either of his line mates, because there's a big gap there and how much Tocchet likes what he's getting from Sam Lafferty, but also Nils Höglander, who I didn't think had a great game last night.
Yeah, although, man, they need Höglander.
They're
to be
going
more
to need Höglander to play more and
yes.
to kind of grow into the series more. I understand why his minutes were where they were last night, but I don't think that's tenable. It almost felt like Tocchet had like 7 forwards he really liked in the lineup last night, and hey, they won, but that's not sustainable going forward, and Hoaglander's clearly going to have to be a guy who steps up beyond that. But, you know, we had somebody text in, Petey ain't going to get the puck from Lafferty. I thought Hoggs was gripping the stick a little tight from playoff nerves. Get Mikheyev back up there.
I loved that fourth line last night. I got to say, I loved it. I thought they played awesome. They didn't play a lot, but I thought they were fast. I thought they generated a fair bit. I thought, you know, Tocchet's design on putting together his fastest possible lineup to get the forecheck going, I think ultimately that paid off as the game went along. So, look, I agree. I think Mikheyev's a better option in that spot than Sam Lafferty, and I've been pretty critical of Mikheyev's sort of offensive touch historically, like during his Canucks tenure. But I do agree that I think he's a better bet for the Canucks in that spot at the moment than Lafferty is.
Yeah, and I think they're going to have to find...
My guess, though, is that we see Lafferty get at least another look there.
I would think so.
Yeah.
I mean, if he went there in game one and you win the game, and not that it was, you know, because Lafferty was there that they won the game, but it at least buys you a little bit more rope to keep trying that, right? Like, there's a reason they went to it in game one. They obviously think it can be a solution, and you've bought yourself some extra time. So I would think they go back. Now, again, we saw the Lotto line get out there. We saw them find ways to increase Elias Pettersson's minutes, right? Where he wasn't stapled to Sam Lafferty.
Although, again, so Lotto line, really quickly.
Mm-hmm.
2 minutes, 37 seconds as a trio. Okay? 4 offensive zone starts. So they were really used in a specialized fashion to try and manufacture some offense. 4 high-danger scoring chances against in that deployment. That is stunning.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm not saying I don't want to see it again, but if I was Rick Tocchet, I'd be tempted to not use it again, given those results. Although, again, Pettersson, that was a very near miss on the one chance that he did get, that wrist shot at sort of the left side of the net, which was manufactured from a, you know, partial heavy shift from that line.
And if you're not comfortable going to the Lotto line to juice Pettersson's minutes, right, but you don't want to play his line mates a lot either, like, that puts you in a difficult situation. You got to find a way to get those minutes up.
Pretty telling, though, that they didn't go to it at all in the third period. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, as time ticked off the clock in a game that they were trailing, this thing that they tried in the opening 40 disappeared. I'd read a lot into that and expect that, you know, those intermixed lotto shifts are not going to necessarily be like a fixture of their game plan in game two. Although, obviously, that's my interpretation, my assumption of what Tocchet will do. We'll see what he actually does.
And we've had other people text in, you know, suggest, hey, what about putting Lindholm with Elias Pettersson? I guess that would probably mean moving Pettersson to the wing, and you reunite Bluger with Garland and Joshua. Now that opens up a hole on the fourth line center, unless you're moving Suter back down there. But Suter played really well with JT Miller, right? And if Lindholm is going to have those types of performances with Garland and Joshua, I think Rick Tocchet's going to be pretty reluctant to break up that trio. So I think, you know, Hoglander is going to have to step up and play well. PD is going to have to be better, certainly, than he was last night. And I think as long as you're getting games like that from Miller, Besser, Suter, and Lindholm, Joshua, Garland, you're going to keep those lines together, and then you're just going to have to cobble something together around Pettersson to make it work, because there should be friendly matchups available for that line, and they should find a way to be able to generate some heavy pressure here. Somebody texts in, what about subbing in Pod Colson for somebody? Well, as you said, fourth line played really well. You know, they use Phil DiGiuseppe on the penalty kill sometimes, so that gives him a little bit of extra utility from Pod Colson. I don't see an obvious spot for Vasily Podkolzin to draw back into the lineup. Certainly not after game one. That time could come, but I don't see it, and I don't see him as a solution to like generating more offense when Elias Pettersson is out there either.
No. I mean, and I think Tocchet liked the speed. And he should have. I thought Phil DiGiuseppe played well for the most part. I mean, with the exception, I guess, of the penalty on Ryan O'Reilly, which was a no-doubter. We're also getting some commentary in about the officiating. I thought that was a pretty well-officiated game.
Mm-hmm.
I thought the refs let a lot go and let sort of a physical game environment permeate. I mean, that Myers hit that could have been boarding, for example, I like that it wasn't, because it was cool. It was like mean, and it was physical, and it was fun. And I thought they really allowed the players to throw like heavy hits that were on the borderline but weren't dangerous, and really were calling stuff that I didn't feel like they had an option not to call, like the Filip Hronek holding the stick, the trip. You know, it's like a two-handed trip on Ryan O'Reilly. I didn't think there was a lot of option to not call that. So I liked a lot of what I saw, actually, from how that game was officiated, especially from a flow perspective, even if the penalty distribution ended up being a little bit unequal, which is, you know, a reminder, too, that like the ref's job isn't to call four penalties on each team.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's to call the infractions that occur.
Although the refs are sometimes confused about that.
That they are.
They sometimes get it in their head that their job is to call equal penalties on both teams. But I also loved how Rick Tocchet, you know, in classic Rick Tocchet fashion, was like, really well officiated game last night in his post-game press.
I thought it was, though. I think he was right. I think he was right. He also said he didn't think the team played undisciplined, which I thought was true to an extent.
I thought the Hronek one, that's some lack of discipline behind your net as the puck's going the other way, right? And he's holding on to the stick.
Yeah, you know, actually, now that I think about it, the only call that happened in the game that I actually thought was a bit soft was the Canucks power play off the Sam Lafferty, when Sam Lafferty was interfered with.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was not a penalty, so I thought it was a pretty well officiated game overall. I believe Tocchet. I think Tocchet meant it this time.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah, no, I just think it was politics.
And look, again, as he said, his team wasn't necessarily undisciplined, even though they did take more penalties than Nashville. But discipline will be a key, certainly in the next game. You know, we've talked so much about how the penalties spike early in the series and then tend to go down. So I think next game, discipline has to be a major, major talking point for the Canucks. But as Rick Tocchet spoke about, you want to find that line where you are playing really, really physically. You're bringing that energy, but you're not losing your discipline. And Matt from Surrey texted in, can we talk about how impactful Myers and Zadorov were physically? They were monsters.
I thought Tyler Myers had one of his best games.
100%.
For me. He was so 100%. Good. He was so good on the PK. He was calling himself out on a couple clears post-game, and he's not wrong about that. Like, there were a couple, in particular, one in the second period that you definitely would have liked to see him put down ice. But man, I thought he won a ton of pucks down low and was just an all around problem for the Predators power play. And again, I really think that game turned when Nashville kind of missed their opportunity to put the Canucks to bed, Steph Curry style, with that run of power play opportunities they had late in the second. So for me anyway, I thought Tyler Myers was a huge part of what the Canucks did well 4-on-5. I thought he was a monster in that phase of the game. Nikita Zadorov, honestly, physical play, you know what to expect from him. I thought the best part of his game, though, was with the puck. I thought he did a lot of supporting stuff on the breakout while also avoiding the sort of giveaways, right? Because, like, Zadorov's one of those NBA shooters that sometimes teams leave open and they're like, yeah, but he can still make them. Right, they say them the no yes guys, like no yes, right? Zadorov can profile like that as a puck mover, but when he avoids the mistake and moves the puck the way he did last night, I thought he had some really compelling, assertive, impactful shifts, helping the Canucks get through the Predators in the neutral zone. So I thought the whole Canucks defense corps had a really good game in my view. I thought Hronek was really strong.
I thought that was Hronek's best game in months. Maybe, honestly, his best game as a Canuck as well. I know he had some really good offensive nights, but I thought that was the performance I've been wanting to see from Filip Hronek for a long time now. And I thought just in general, like, the depth of the Canucks' blue line looked really good.
Held up really well.
Right?
Yeah.
And then again, you look at the ice time, the story the ice time tells. At 5-on-5, Quinn Hughes plays just under 18 minutes. Nikita Zadorov right around 17. Tyler Myers, 16.5. Carson Soucy, 16.20. Filip Hronek, 16.16. Ian Cole, just above 14. That's a pretty tight bunching of your six defensemen at 5-on-5. And I think that speaks to the fact that all of them played pretty well. And I think that is an edge that the Canucks can have in this series. I didn't think the bottom pairing, or really even the bottom two pairings, I didn't think played great for Nashville last night. Now, I think their second pairing will have better nights, right? Like Carrier-Lauzon.
Carrier-Lauzon, though, were their matchup pair last night.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think it's worth wondering if that's something that they can afford to stick with.
Yeah, if it has to be Yossi McDonagh.
Well, especially... Or if they have to split Yossi McDonagh.
If they have to move McDonagh to a matchup role.
And the other thing is, Yossi spent so much of his ice time with the O'Reilly group. They really played that as a five-man unit for almost 10 minutes together, 5-on-5, Yossi and O'Reilly. If you're going to use Carrier and Lauzon in matchup minutes, do you need to make sure that they're with Ryan O'Reilly more frequently than they're with McCarron?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, I think that's going to be sort of something that the Predators will have to look at, consider, as they stare at a whiteboard and prepare for game two.
But I thought that was probably pretty close to what management and the coaching staff envision in their mind's eye when they put this blue line together,
oh,
right?
Yeah.
With the addition of Zadorov, the size from Myers, the size from Carson Soucy, and then, you know, just the reliable play from Ian Cole and, you know, the stud at the top in Quinn Hughes, and then Filip Hronek really looking like that legit second defenseman. Like, that was very much, I thought, the blueprint performance, and the physicality is going to get a lot of the attention, and it's understandable. Tyler Myers reminding me a little bit of, remember Alex Edler, how he would, like, every game one without fail in the playoffs throw like a monster hit
would crush Drew Doughty.
Yeah, just to remind everyone, like, hey, by the way, you don't see it a lot in the regular season, but I'm a physical monster when I want to be. It felt like a little bit of that type of performance from Tyler Myers. You know what I mean? Like, hey, by the way, I'm giant and really strong.
Although the physical side of it was obviously present, but it honestly didn't feel we see Myers throw big hits, I think, in the regular season here and there. What stood out to me as distinct was the like elevated composure and disruptiveness defensively. Cause that's what I felt like he brought last night. And that's what I feel like was, not a bigger departure from his norm, but something that really caught my attention throughout the game.
Yeah, and they need those. They're going to need those types of minutes from Myers, from Zadorov, and as you said, the physicality is great, and that's going to be huge for them. But more than anything, if you're just feeling comfortable enough in those bottom two pairings that you're not hiding them, you're not looking for the soft matchups, right? And, you know, that will change if they advance past this series, potentially, depending on who they're matched up against. But it just felt like Rick Tocchet had fewer kind of headaches and things to plan around, at least on the back end, than Andrew Brunette did. And I thought you saw that in a big way last night with the performance of the Canucks defensemen, even beyond Quinn Hughes and Philip Roenick at the top of the lineup. Lots of texts coming in here. 650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. And, you know, lots of thoughts about the forward lines and what they might do. This one says this team is just so much better balanced with Lindholm at 3C. Certainly, we heard from Patrick Alvin on the pregame show yesterday that he loves having those options down the middle, that strength down the middle when you slot Lindholm in at the third line center, and then you have Blueger playing on your fourth line. It does give the team so much depth down the middle. So I think they're going to be really, really reluctant to go away from that depth down the middle look, but we'll see. And, you know, somebody else texted in, like, how much time can Rick Tocchet waste moving people around and trying to get Elias Pettersson going? They're paying him X amount. He's got to find a way to get going. And I don't disagree with that. But having said that, you also need to put your players in a position to succeed. Like, both things can be true at once. That Pettersson needs to be better, that Pettersson needs to elevate his line mates, and also that he's being asked to do a lot when you're giving him Sam Lafferty on his line. That's not excusing Elias Pettersson. That's not saying he can't be better. That's not saying he doesn't need to be better. He does, but we can also acknowledge the context that he's going to work in these games. Keep those texts coming in. 650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. As mentioned, Allison Lucan covering the Kraken, but of course she's plugged in. She's watching everything that happens in the NHL playoffs. So we'll get her to weigh in on the Canucks and the Predators and some of the other playoff action. We haven't even talked about what else is going on around the NHL, but we'll find some time to do that.
Because who cares?
What? Come on, that Edmonton, or not Edmonton, Winnipeg, Colorado game didn't do it for you? Oh, that was wild.
Did it for me in a major way.
That was absolutely wild.
Ton of fun. But in past years, it's been like, let's watch other teams and discuss what it means for the Canucks.
But now it's more just, it works so much better as like an appetizer or a palate cleanser. You know what I mean? Where it's not the main course, watching other teams.
I will say, I'm excited for tonight.
Yeah, it's going to be great.
Awesome.
It's going to be really good. All right, Allison Lucan coming up here on Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650.
Hey, it's Mike Halford
and Jason Brough.
Join us for Halford and Brough in the Morning weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m. on Sportsnet 650.
Or on demand anytime through your favorite podcast app.
Welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Trance, live from the Kintech studio. 650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Dunbar Lumber with three stores to serve you in Ladner on Bridge Street, or Dunbar Lumber Express at Ladner Center.
You're on fire, man.
Or Arbutus in Vancouver, online at dunbarlumber.com. I'm hyped. I'm hyped, man. I don't know if I'm going to be able to keep this energy up on ad reads.
I'm going to be honest with you. You were like really hyped about the Dunbar Lumber Express at Ladner Center, and not nearly as hyped about the one on Bridge Street or on Arbutus. So,
which you'd think, Arbutus is so much closer to me. You'd think that would be my favorite.
Well, and Arbutus is the one that's actually in Dunbar.
That's true.
It's the Dunbar Lumber.
Although, is Arbutus part of Dunbar? I don't know about that.
Yeah, I guess not.
Got to get at Ken Priestley about that. What's the deal, bud? Anyways, enough of that. Now joining us on the line, very pleased to be talking NHL playoffs with her. Of course, she regularly covers Seattle Kraken, but excited to chat Stanley Cup playoffs in general with her. She is Allison Lucan. Allison, thank you as always for joining us. How are you?
Well, I too am excited about Dunbar Lumber now. My goodness gracious, I'm great. Thanks for having me, guys.
It's truly our pleasure. Look, that's what radio is all about, the local flavor. And now you know, if you're in Vancouver and you need lumber, you know where to go, Allison. That's the service we provide. What did you think about game one between the Canucks and the Predators? Was there anything that kind of stood out or surprised you about how the first game in this series went?
You know, I must say, with all credit to that game, it was a great game, and yeah. The fans were incredible. The energy was awesome, but I felt bad for people who were doing all four games in a row, because coming off the chaos,
right,
of that 6-7 game with the Jets and the Avs before, it definitely took a different tone. But I think what I liked about it the most was seeing the Canucks kind of come out, getting their feet back wet in playoff hockey, maybe looking a little bit hesitant in terms of finding back their footing, and then really embracing it and putting that one down in the win column at the end of the full 60.
What was your sense of how this matchup might look coming into the series, Allison?
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting one, right? Because mm-hmm. you've got Nashville that's on such a tear and is basically playing with house money. No one predicted them to be here. And then you've got the Canucks, and we've talked about this all season when we've had our calls, and I know many people say this, it's not groundbreaking. You know, the Canucks are built for a good long run this year. They have a number one goaltender, they have a number one forward, and they have a number one defender. So they were certainly the team to beat. But I was curious how they would handle Nashville's kind of desire to quick strike and the physicality of it. And to that end, what I really liked after this first game one, and we all know it's only just a game one, is how the Canucks eventually were able to win more battles, both getting loose pucks, but also on forechecking and retrieving dump-ins. And I think that was a big key to why everything worked for them last night.
Is that, I mean, as you said, it's one game, and, you know, a series is never going to be decided by just one factor. But coming out of that game, for me, it did kind of feel like the Canucks' forecheck versus the Predators' ability to really quickly transition the puck when they're on top of their game, that might be kind of the deciding factor in this series, right? If the Canucks, as you said, that game really turned once they started having more success on the forecheck, does it feel like that's really the kind of tactical battle to watch in this series to you?
Yeah, for me, it sure does. And, you know, it's funny, I was looking up some numbers, as we're wont to do if you're a nerd mm-hmm. like me. And the Canucks were +9 in forechecking scoring chances. They had a 34-18 advantage in offensive zone takeaways, and they were +30 on those loose puck recoveries in the offensive zone. Mm. Both teams were able to exit pretty well, but it was Vancouver that was able to get into the zone better and then again capitalize on winning the puck however that needed to be done, and that's what fed their overall success for me.
When you consider how that game looked, the Predators spent a lot of time sort of punting the matchup with JT Miller, with McCarron being Miller's most common line mate head-to-head. Is that something where, you know, so long as the Canucks don't do damage in those minutes, it creates easier sledding for the rest of Nashville's lineup, and maybe there's a knock-on effect that's positive there from the Preds' perspective? Or is it something they may have to consider going away from in game two, in your view?
Yeah, these are the games within the game, right? Mm-hmm. And I don't mind it when you don't have last change, that you're just going to acquiesce a little bit. But I think this is another area where Vancouver has the advantage over their current opponent, is that even if you give up the top matches, the depth is still there. And this has been really fun for me these past couple of years. I actually covered Dakota Joshua when he was at Ohio State.
Wow.
And so to see him now doing this, to be honest with you, with full respect to the player, I would not have predicted this as a trajectory for him. And so to see him stick like he has, particularly this season, and then have a game like he had last night, I think it is a really, really impressive statement for him. But also, again, speaks to the fact that even if you decide to shy away from a couple matchups, the Canucks have enough depth and enough players who seem to be willing to turn it on right now, even Lindholm, to say no matchup's going to be easy for you wherever you go.
Yeah, that's. I didn't realize that you had covered Dakota Joshua all the way back in his university, his college hockey days. And, you know, it's been a really, it's been one of the coolest storylines. There's been so many great storylines for the Canucks, but to see the development of Dakota Joshua this year, and especially the chemistry he's found with Connor Garland, they've had a few different centers at different points playing between them. But, you know, as we saw on the eventual game-winning goal, very different players, right? But there's just something about they've found a way to click. And when they're on, which they have been most of the year this year, they just add that extra layer of danger to the Canucks attack.
100%. And it's interesting, right, to look at, to your point, a chemistry developing and being preserved between the two wingers, right? Usually we see a center-winger combo, yeah, and then you play with that other wing. So it's really, really interesting. But I think, you know, if you look at Dakota Joshua way back when I was covering him at Ohio State, this wasn't a quote-unquote highly talented offensive player. And he was a grinder. He had a little bit of learning to do in terms of walking that line of physicality versus crossing the line. And so, you know, what he has shown is that he's really been able to mature. You know, I talk to development coaches about this a lot. Mature those transferable skills, the skills that are going to keep you in the league if you're not a top three, top six guy. He's really solidified those, and then he's put in the work to up what he can do offensively. I mean, that shot from the behind the net pass from Garland was, I mean, he had a perfect sight line, but that was something that we didn't necessarily expect from him all those years ago. So I really like what he's done. And again, when you see a coach recognize that you can keep two wingers together and play with what's happening in the middle, that's really fascinating to me.
Allison, when you sort of look at this side of the bracket, the Pacific side of the bracket that the Canucks have found themselves in with the Predators jumping over, I know on paper, right, Colorado, Vegas, Dallas might be like sexier Stanley Cup picks, but on form, like in the second half of the season, you've kind of got like four of the top nine teams in terms of, you know, controlling play 5-on-5, certainly by sort of the score adjusted metrics in Nashville, Edmonton, LA, and Vancouver. Putting yourself in the shoes of a Canucks fan or analyst, or coach or executive, how do you sort of handicap how this has broken for Vancouver in terms of what it looks like on their path to potentially the conference final?
Yeah, you know, I think that, you know, we of course love our numbers and those things are true, but we still look at the makeup of these teams. And as I've said, I think right now, two of your deepest teams are Vancouver and Dallas, and they're not set to meet each other for a little bit here. And Dallas certainly has the harder road. I mean, they're facing Vegas. We're going to see what that looks like tonight. But, you know, again, what I did see to start that game was I was like, come on, Canucks, let's go. Click into it. Click into how you play. Click into looking like yourself. Once they found that confidence, I saw them look a lot more effective. If that underlying confidence, if those intangibles can continue to sustain, and, of course, if they can stay healthy, we all know how that can change the trajectory in the postseason. I don't think it's certainly not the hardest path, let me say that.
You know, and one of the other things that stood out to me, Allison, was the performance of the Canucks blue line last night. And I know, you know, since we've been doing the show and having these conversations with you on a semi-regular basis, it's always been a question of, can the Canucks find the solutions on the blue line beyond Quinn Hughes, right? And obviously they go out and they make a big trade for Filip Hronek. They sign Carson Soucy. They sign Ian Cole. They trade for Nikita Zadorov. And all of a sudden, you know, and even a holdover like Tyler Myers, slotted down a little bit farther down the lineup. He plays really well last night. And all of a sudden, you know, I looked at their performance as a group in that game one against Nashville, and it feels like the coaching staff, management, like that's what they were envisioning when they assembled this blue line. It's such a turnaround from where the Canucks were. Does it feel like a defensive group that has the chance, has the ability to be part of the team that does go deep in the playoffs to you?
Yeah, it does to me. And, you know, again, we want to give full respect to the Predators, but there's going to be tougher competition lying ahead, we presume, should the Canucks advance. But, you know, I shared some numbers earlier, and one of the things that I always like to look at are two numbers when you look at evaluating defense, beyond goals against or possession time or shots against, and that's, can they get the puck out of the zone? And the Canucks were +5 in breakouts and stretch passes last night, which was awesome. And then again, while both teams had pretty similar exit rates, it was Nashville that struggled on their entries. And so that, again, to me, speaks to the ability to shut down at the blue line and say, we're not letting you pass. And I think those are really important behaviors to watch going forward. But yes, I think that, you know, as long as Carson Soucy can tend to take a penalty when you don't like it, and he did that last night, but as long as we can keep that all in check, I think this is a solid group right now.
Yeah, Tyler Myers has had that a little bit in his career as well. But, you know, as you mentioned, the kind of the transitional defense we've seen this year, and I know you're familiar after his time in Seattle as well, but how good Carson Soucy can be at denying those zone entries. And certainly that's made a huge difference for the Canucks this year. I did want to ask about some of the other series, especially in the Western Conference. You know, two of them get going tonight, and in one of them, LA and Edmonton, a rematch of the first round matchup from the last 2 years. Of course, Edmonton has been victorious in both of those. Are you expecting more of the same in this matchup?
Well, unfortunately, yes, I am. You know, I think that these are two teams that have questions about goaltending. They've kind of battled them up and down all season. But again, it's similar to how we talk about the Canucks right now. I think Edmonton just has more sustained attack and threat up and down their lineup as compared to LA. And of course, you know, LA makes that move to bring over Big Fish Pierre-Luc Dubois. They spend a lot. Look at how much other assets have helped Winnipeg as a result of that trade. And if he can become playoff PL, then LA is going to be really dangerous. But he has to answer that question for himself. And right now, I put the edge in Edmonton's corner.
Does this feel like Edmonton's year, or that it needs to be Edmonton's year for you, given how well they played after that disaster start and then the coaching change?
You know how I feel about Edmonton. But you know, it's an interesting question, but I honestly am not ready to say it's Edmonton's year yet. And I do point to things like even little things like the decision to not go for that goaltender interference call last night with Tocchet, but just some overall coaching changes and, choices. Having the Canucks ready all year and then having the support of the decision makers making good decisions behind the bench, I think might prove to be even more valuable. And that's no knock to Chris Knobloch at all, but I might give an edge in terms of the bench management and the strategic planning on a team like the Canucks over Edmonton.
And the other series in the West that gets going tonight, Dallas and Vegas. And of course, there'll be a lot of conversation about Mark Stone coming back for game one once again. But as you said, Dallas looking like one of, if not clearly the deepest team in the league.
Can I jump in? I just want to ask Allison. Allison, when did hockey Twitter become cap compliance cops?
Right. Who bought that to make that change? We'll see.
Yeah. Like, why is hockey Twitter? Why are we all feds now when it comes to cap compliance?
Go ahead.
Do you have a Mark Stone take?
You know what? Here's the thing. And if you listen to any GM when they're talking, they're going to say, if there's a loophole I can find that's legal but gives me an advantage, I'm going to do it. It's the exact same logic we ask them to apply when they're out scouting. It's the exact same logic we ask them to apply when they're looking for which free agent to sign or how to make a trade. So here, it's truly just actual currency that they're doing it with. And if they're in the letter of the law, this is what it is. And quite frankly, I would rather see a full roster of the Golden Knights take on a full roster of the Stars than have some sort of, oh, he's in timeout because we don't like how he got healthy at this point after what's not an insignificant injury. I'm fine with it right now, honestly.
Well, and the thing that I always come back to is we all know, as much as we're like, oh, what a coincidence, he's ready to go for game one, we all know that there's injuries that keep a player out of regular season games that they play through for playoffs, right? That's one of the reasons we love the playoffs, is because guys are willing to fight through the pain, to you know, fight through what they wouldn't normally deal with in order to get on the ice. So I don't think it's a surprise that, you know, it's not hard to conceptualize, right, that Mark Stone is in enough pain that he's not going to play in the regular season, but that he can push through it to play for the playoffs. And that, like, there's no way to eliminate that factor from the game.
100%. And again, you know, this isn't even a bruise or a broken bone or a strain. I mean, this is a lacerated spleen. That seems to me to be pretty significant. And to your point, we've also seen teams sit players to make sure that they are in fact healthy for the postseason. So if you're looking at a margin of 1 to 2 games before Mark Stone comes back, and you can rightly keep him out so that he comes back and doesn't risk an injury in those last two regular season games, again, then go complain to all the other teams who did that. Carolina pulled out, what, 8 players their last regular season game? So, again, we want to see the best versus the best, and that's the best way to earn your next step and hopefully your championship. So again, it doesn't bother me at all.
Yeah, and as you said, at least it should make the series between Vegas and Dallas more entertaining. Now, as I was saying, you said Dallas probably the deepest team in the Western Conference at this point. I look at that roster, I think they're probably going to be my pick to come out of the West. Do you see them as the favorites in the Western Conference?
Yeah, they are honestly my pick right now, because I think what's really interesting is we aren't talking enough about how Jim Nill and his team have built this roster, right? They were a strong team. Some of their veterans are kind of aging out of their prime years. And this organization, very quietly without fanfare, has found a way to now just start rolling out waves of talent, right? And when you see Wyatt Johnston now with the ability to tip in pucks, you wonder, is that because he's sitting there on a line with Joe Pavelski, one of the greatest to do it of all time? And so you're not just having continuity of talent, you're building depth, you're developing, and again, you've been able to do this across all three parts of your game, offense, defense, and goaltending. And so I just think that they are arguably, again, health being a huge factor here, Jake Oettinger getting back on his game has been a huge plus as well, but they have been my pick for the past probably 6 weeks or so.
Allison, really appreciate the time and the insight, some great numbers and some great information on the Canucks and the Predators game one. Looking forward to doing this again.
I'm looking forward to it as well. Shayna and Sarah, say hi.
Yes. Thank you. That is Allison Lucan, of course, covering the Kraken for Root Sports Northwest. But you know, even like going back to covering Dakota Joshua at Ohio State.
Yeah,
I did not know that. That was awesome.
Roasted.
Oh, we deserve it. It's fine. Yeah, whatever. Who cares? It's a bit now. It's fun.
It's a bit.
And we didn't do it that time. We were very polite.
No, we were awesome.
We were great.
We killed it.
We absolutely
Dom's
nailed
just
it.
Jealous. I asked Dom, because I like had to run to the bathroom during break. I asked him if he'd bring me a water, and he brought me a boiling water.
Did he actually?
Not just boiling water, but like in the most obnoxious.
Yeah,
cup
in like
possible.
A soup bowl. What is going on over here?
And then
crushed it, Dom.
And then he threw me the double birdie and walked out. That's our producer, baby.
That's put it. You know what?
Dom, do you see what I'm working with? Let's do it live. All right, let's go to break. This is fun.
No, we can't go to break.
Why?
We got.
Oh, we have time.
4 minutes, 5 minutes before we got to go to break. That's
sorry.
Why. What do you mean why?
Let's go to break to troll Dom. Come on. We can do this.
I dare you to go to break.
I'm not going to break now. I don't want to do like a 40-minute segment on the other side. Are you kidding
me? You're
just
hurting yourself.
Yeah, that's cutting off my nose despite my face there. I'm not doing. Why do you think I go long? Because I want to shorten the next segment.
I'm sorry. I lost track of time. We were having so much fun.
We were having so much
fun. And also, I'm so thirsty.
just have some of that piping hot water.
Good. Thanks.
Nothing quenches your thirst like some boiling water. All right. Speaking of having so much fun, another 4 games on the playoff schedule.
Let's go.
Tonight. I mean, okay. Do you want to look back at the other playoff games quickly here for the next 4 minutes, or look ahead to tonight's games?
Well, let's,
your choice, buddy.
I want to talk. I'm down to talk some Avs.
Okay.
I thought the Avs defense was horrible. I thought the Winnipeg Jets got literally whatever they wanted every time they were set up in the Avalanche zone. And yeah, did Georgiev play well? No. Did he get beaten on goals that like were stinkers? Like, he didn't have a goal against that was as bad as Saros's goal
on Lindholm.
On Lindholm.
Mm-hmm.
Not even close. The Morrissey one was from long distance, and I swear it went through like 3 layered screens, and all of those guys were unchecked. The Avs, and
both Lowry goals were sick. So that one, my biggest takeaway, honestly, was like, I didn't know pucks could do that. I was like, what the heck?
Yeah, Lowry.
I was absolutely wild.
Lowry's a problem. You know, remember my Mason Appleton love?
Mm-hmm.
I've realized in retrospect, like as I sort of try and go through, like, what did I get wrong here? What signal did I miss, right? And Appleton's had a good bounce back season. I still think he's a useful player, but he certainly wasn't as good as what I thought. Like, I thought he was a guy who could level up as a second liner, heavy press type. And I think what I got wrong mostly was I just massively underrated Adam Lowry.
Mm.
Like, I'm serious. I think Adam Lowry is just really, really good.
Yeah, the talking point coming out of that game was all about the Gorgiev, right? Yeah. But yeah, there were a lot of grade A chances, dude, against the grain for the Winnipeg Jets.
I'm telling you right now, more than Gorgiev getting right, if the Avs defend like that, this is a quick series and it's going to go in.
And I also
favorite.
Think if you're the Colorado Avalanche, you know, I was talking about missed opportunities for the Nashville Predators. You got six past Connor Hellebuck, and you weren't even really close to winning the game. Like, that hurts. You got six past the guy who's going to win the Vezina, and you didn't. Technically, it's a one goal game because you score with 30 seconds left, but you weren't particularly close.
Well, yeah, you deflect one off Brendan Dillon's shoulder.
Yeah.
Anyway, the honestly, the goalie that I think I'd be talking about the most coming out of that game actually was Hellebuck, not because of the six goals against, whatever, that can happen, especially when your team's leading by the margin that the Jets were against a team
against
that generates chances
Avalanche.
Like the Avs do, but toward the in that third period, the way that he was getting up, he looked tired. He looked like he'd seen too many shots. I'm actually curious to see if we might see Laurent Brossoit in this series.
Wow. If they get up?
Yeah.
Or just as like a on a hook or something?
It looked to me like he needed it. Like, it just, if I'm them now, the schedule lays out so that they play Tuesday and then not again till Friday. So that's a benefit.
Mm-hmm.
That's a benefit for the Avs here, for the Jets here. But I thought as that game went along, you could visibly, you could see signs of serious fatigue on Hellebuck. And that would obviously concern me because it's only game one of what you hope is a long run, and the Jets ain't going nowhere without Hellebuck being on his game.
The Avs are also just still, I know that, you know, they added Mittelstadt, right, and that helped them a lot, but they're so dangerous when Nathan MacKinnon is out there, but they're so reliant on Nathan MacKinnon. You know what I mean?
Yep.
Like, and look, I get it. He's a phenomenal player, so
but
how
the
much
Canucks are too with Quinn Hughes.
Sure.
Especially to generate offense.
But it's just like, I feel like the gap is just so big.
Yeah.
And I think it's also because Nathan MacKinnon is just, he's such a loud player. Like, he attracts the eye and attracts the attention so powerfully because he looks terrifying every time he picks up the puck in that. But it's just like the contrast between when he's on the ice doing his thing for the Avs and when he's not on the ice doing his things for the Avs is just absolutely massive. Now, look, they could still easily come back and win that series. I picked them to win, but yeah, that defensive performance was not a stellar one from the Colorado Avalanche.
Just remember, losing to the Jets in game one tends to be a good sign.
It's great. That was the secret for the Vegas Golden Knights last night.
The moment Jets fans are like, we got a shot, the Stanley Cup contender, the real Stanley Cup contender emerges.
Wakes up. Okay, get your texts in, 650-650 to the Dunbar Lumber text message inbox. We will continue to break down game one between the Canucks and the Preds.
So you picked the Avs.
Mm-hmm.
Last year, you really bought into that first Winnipeg game.
No, not doing it this year.
No?
No. That says more about the Avs to me than it does about the Jets.
I think I'm going to be the opposite. I'm the one.
Well, now, I'm not saying
I picked the Jets, but I'm buying Jet stock in this series. I think they, I don't think the Avs defend well enough.
That's fair. And I'm not saying like, oh, the Jets are definitely going to lose this series still, but I'm not buying them, like buying Stanley Cup Jets stock. You know what I mean? As a result of that performance. It says
neither am I.
Yeah, it says more bad about the Avs than it did good about the Jets.
But I'm buying Jets to advance stock.
That's
sure.
Fair. Okay, we'll take a break. Lots more coming up. We'll have some information, hopefully, from Canucks practice. Sounds like it was pretty optional. Light skate at Rogers Arena. We'll look ahead to game two. Take your text as well here on Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650.